Donald Trump would call them losers. I'm Kay McIntyre, and today on KPR Presents, men who ran for president several times and lost. Every year, the Dole Institute of Politics at the University of Kansas holds its popular presidential lecture series, featuring presidential historian Richard Norton Smith. This year's series, Presidential Also-Rans, candidates who ran for president, lost, but shaped politics and history in lasting ways. In the midst of the 2016 presidential campaigns, a little historical perspective on the race for president, reaching back to the 19th century. On today's program, Richard Norton Smith talks about three presidential candidates who shaped politics of their day. Henry Clay, who ran and lost in 1824, 1832, and 1844. James Blaine, who ran in 1876, 1880, and 1884. And finally, William Jennings Bryan, who ran in 1896 and 1900. This event was moderated by Bill Lacey, director of the Dole Institute of Politics. And now, presidential historian Richard Norton Smith.
In case any of you were not aware, we're having a presidential election this year. And I don't know about you, I have long since grown weary of the endless punditry and poll monitoring and everything that passes for coverage of current presidential politics. And historians are in the perspective business, at least we like to think, which means we like to step back and try to see things against a broader horizon. And which is another way of saying we prefer to live in the past, particularly when the present is the alternative that we are going through as we speak. So anyway, it seemed to me that at a time when a lot of people are also clearly disenchanted with the state of things in the country, when people left and right seem to believe whatever it means, we're not going in the right direction, that it would be useful and would provide some perspective and hopefully some entertainment to take a look at other presidential elections, and particularly at those candidates who, although they didn't win the presidency, nevertheless made a real contribution in ways, in some cases we'll talk about today, you can build direct bridges from William Jennings Bryan, for example, to the modern Democratic Party. And lest we forget, this place is named for one of those individuals. And so it seemed like an appropriate time and place to do it. Today we'll look at the 19th century and three candidates who would seem to have very little in common, beginning with Henry Clay, who some of you may remember from textbook history, you know, the great compromiser, and you probably don't know much more about him than that. James G. Blaine, who I guarantee you know nothing about, except maybe he's the other half of that, the continental liar from the state of Maine slogan in the particularly vicious campaign of 1884, and William Jennings Bryan, who in a whole lot of ways has his roots in Kansas, Nebraska, and in ways that we'll talk about. Just a couple things, though, that actually do unite. All three of these men did something that I don't think a modern candidate could hope to do, and that is they ran three times. They had very prolonged national exposure. They were polarizing figures. The fact of the matter is, for 40 years in this country, you could start an argument by mentioning the name Henry Clay. The only person more polarizing was his great nemesis, Andrew Jackson. And in fact, if you think of Hamilton and Jefferson defining the early republic, the second chapter of that story is Clay and Jackson. Jackson famously on his deathbed was asked if he had any regrets. And he said, yes, that I didn't shoot Henry Clay or hang John C. Calhoun. I don't know what Henry Clay said on his deathbed, but I'm sure it was equally pungent. Clay was a prodigy. Clay was, in some respects, a genius. And I don't know how many geniuses you know, but genius is unbalanced. Clay was elected Speaker of the House on his first day as a young congressman. I mean, that's never been done. He is regarded as the greatest speaker. Now, as long as he was Speaker of the House, he had a very interesting view of power and where it rested in the constitutional system. It rested with the Speaker, not with the President. And he outlined his philosophy very succinctly. It was very simple. Basically, the Speaker represented the majority of the majority of the people's house. Therefore, the Speaker spoke for the people. Therefore, the Speaker's weight should be predominant in determining national policy. The role of the executive was simply, as indeed the founders had intended, arguably, to carry out what Congress legislated. This did not reckon with a temperament or a personality like Andrew Jackson, who held a very different view of power, congressional and legislative. But Clay had come from a very poor background in rural Virginia. He moved to Kentucky as a young man, grew up with the state, became a lawyer, star lawyer, went into politics, was unnatural, and was considered, the other thing that all three of these have in common, and it's a shame because it is the 19th century, we don't have any film of Henry Clay. We don't have any recordings of what everyone talked about as his bell-like voice. You know, he's a great orator in an age when oratory was not only political persuasion, but popular entertainment. We only have second and third hand accounts of the effect of Clay's charisma. And charisma, under the best of circumstances, is very difficult to put into words. You had to be there. But in any event, take my word for it, each in their own ways, James G. Blaine, who, if you look at a picture, looks like an indistinguishable from all those other overfed Civil War generals, you know, who occupied the White House for one term, unmemorably, in the years after the Civil War. Nothing particularly, and yet he was known as the magnetic man. I mean, millions of people. The other thing that's unique about that period and sets it apart from our own, people were born into a religious denomination and a political party. And the odds were they never deviated from either for as long as they were conscious. Clay helped to create the second party system. When the Federalist Party died early in the 19th century, remember, the Federalists had believed in a strong central government as a tool for economic development. The Federalists believed in a generous interpretation of the Constitution. For example, they were nationalists. They wanted to build roads and canals. They wanted to develop this raw country. And they were perfectly comfortable with the idea of using the federal government to do so. Their opposition, whether under Jefferson or Jackson, took a much narrower view of government at all levels, but particularly the federal government. Because remember, they were descended from English Whigs, who, and after all, we had rebelled against centralized authority from a distant monarch. In this case, the Jeffersonians and Jacksonians had no desire to see us set up a Federalist monarch, even if his name was George Washington. But Henry Clay inherited that Hamiltonian strain. So he believed in a national bank. 80 years before there was a Federal Reserve, Clay understood that national great. The phrase that Bill Kristol coined a few years ago, some of you may remember, national greatness conservatism. That's Henry Clay. Managing at one and the same time to recognize there are limits to what federal government can do, but being comfortable with the federal government as an engine of business development. Now you can see where this is going, because over the 19th century, that evolves into the Republican Party, which is not only the party that is against slavery, but increasingly is the party that is seen as pro-business, big business. Its critics think even owned by business. Clay was a doer. Clay was a womanizer. Clay drank. In all of these respects, he was like his peers. Where he was unlike his peers was this extraordinary capacity he had to draw people to him, and particularly when he opened his mouth. And there's nothing harder to convey 200 years later than reading the cold words on a page. It just doesn't. I looked at some, and they feel so stilted. I mean, the modern ear is simply not attuned. So it's very difficult. But take my word for it. When Clay walked into a room, everyone knew something special was about to happen. He ran for president 5 times. He got the nominee. He was nominated 3 times. And again, that's something. William Jennings Bryan was nominated 3 times, and James G. Blaine ran 3 times, got the nomination once. And it's a bit of a mystery to me why, in the 19th century, people could sustain. You know the last Democrat to be renominated after losing? Yeah, Adlai Stevenson in 1956. Now, Richard Nixon in 1968 broke the rules. And before that, Tom Dewey in 1948. I think the difference is, I think the modern media are so voracious. The 24/7 news cycle, we use up our politicians. Just as if you get one chance, you know, and if you strike out, the odds are, you know, the party is not going to give you another one.
Why did Clay never make it? You know, what kept him from being elected?
Timing. I mean, seriously, timing. In 1824, he ran as the candidate of the West. He was very young. It was probably too early. But guess what? There was already a candidate from the West called Andrew Jackson. So that was kind of, the timing was off. 1832, he ran against Jackson's reelection. And he made, and this time it wasn't timing, it was colossal bad judgment. He believed, again, go back to your textbook history, Jackson made war on the Bank of the United States. He would finish what Jefferson hadn't. He would kill the bank. As he said to visitors, the bank thinks they'll kill me, but I'll kill them first. And as usual, he was a man of his word. They did try to kill each other, and Jackson prevailed. And he wrote a brilliant, nakedly class warfare to some, us versus them, proto-populist veto. If you want to understand the politics of the 19th century and a lot of the 20th, you could do worse than sit down and read Andrew Jackson's veto of the bank. There is a direct bridge from the sentiments expressed there to pick one obvious example, what Bernie Sanders is talking about, what William Jennings Bryan talked about at the end of the 19th century. Clay, who was in this bubble, the only way I can put it, of his own certitude, was convinced that Jackson had made a fatal mistake in vetoing the bank. He had convinced himself that the public loved the bank, that the public appreciated the intellectual arguments behind the bank in the way that he did. And he made the fatal error of underestimating Andrew Jackson and Jackson's appeal. The intelligentsia of that time made the same mistake. Andrew Jackson and Ronald Reagan have a lot in common. Both were lethally underestimated by the power brokers of their time. So Clay had an option. The president of the bank said, look, rechartering the bank doesn't come up until after the election of 1832. I want to wait, and then maybe Jackson will take a softer position. And Clay pressed him, no. This is the issue on which we'll win the election. And so he pressed, Jackson vetoed it. Clay printed up 200,000 copies of the veto message to distribute, thinking that it would be great campaign literature. And that gets to, in a roundabout way, there was a fundamental flaw in Clay. There was a fault line of judgment. He was a great statesman. The great compromiser is for real. Although, in the end, Stephen Douglas probably had more to do with the compromise of 1850. The fact is, Clay took the initiative in his old age, a dying man, to try to postpone Civil War. And by postponing that Civil War for 10 years, it seems to me, if he had done nothing else, he would be entitled to our gratitude, because that gave 10 years for the North to grow stronger, and above all, gave 10 years for his fellow Kentuckian and great admirer, Abraham Lincoln, to become Abraham Lincoln. In fact, when Clay died, Lincoln gave the eulogy in Springfield. Lincoln called Clay my beau ideal of a statesman. He was a great statesman. On balance, like the other two candidates we're going to look at, it's probably a good thing he didn't become president.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You kind of just touched on that in reference to the Compromise of 1850 and some other things, but is there anything else on Clay's political legacy that you wanted to cover before we move on?
I would say this. I think we still can learn from Clay's insistence. Compromise has become a dirty word in a lot of quarters, and I guess I understand that. But the fact is, and I think one of the reasons why there is so much anger out there on both the left and the right is that people feel that they've been misled. People feel that they elected people who promised them a certain course of action, and then it didn't happen. And not surprisingly, they're not happy about it. The problem is not with those people. From their standpoint, they're perfectly entitled to harbor the emotions that they do. The problem is with the, quote, statesmen who they elected, who were not honest with them in the first place, in telling them, this is how the system works. If we control half the national government, but we don't control the White House, there are severe limits to what we can deliver, or vice versa. And that rather than suggest to people, hey, like Ronald Reagan used to say, hell, if I can get 80% of what I want in a negotiation, I'll call that a victory. That spirit of compromise, of substantive engagement, especially with people you don't like, especially with people who you may not necessarily trust. You don't negotiate with people who you agree with on everything. You negotiate with people you don't. And Clay understood it, personified it. I mentioned the Compromise of 1850. 30 years earlier, there was the Missouri Compromise, a vital relevance to people here in Kansas. And the fact of the matter is, it was the first great compromise on which Clay built his reputation, bringing Missouri into the Union as a slave state, but keeping the balance in the Senate by also bringing Maine in as a free state. The fact is, we could have had a civil war decades earlier than we did, or no civil war and a breakup of the Federal Union. Henry Clay deserves as much, if not more, credit than anyone for forestalling both of those. And that, it seems to me, is probably a greater tribute than anything he might have done as president.
Okay. Tell us a little bit about James Blaine and how well, he rose to prominence.
There's only a little bit to tell. James Blaine, again, it's hard to believe, but for 30 years in this country, you know, there were two kinds of Americans. There were people who loved Blaine and people who detested him. Much more than, you know, his political opponents. I mean, he roused those emotions. He had a very unusual background. He was actually born in Pennsylvania, and he moved to Kentucky. And by the way, he was a great admirer of Henry Clay. He certainly politically in the Clay tradition. He was, I guess, what you would call a big business Republican. In fact, that got him in trouble when the railroads, which were coming into their own, of course, in the years after the Civil War, were accused with considerable justification of buying votes in Congress, including quite possibly that of Speaker Blaine. Like Henry Clay, Blaine was Speaker of the House. He was a member of the United States Senate. He was twice Secretary of State. By the way, all three of these candidates were Secretary of State at different times. And in the 19th century, it wasn't the vice presidency that was seen as a stepping stone to the presidency, but it was, in fact, to be Secretary of State. So, and in fact, Blaine was a superb Secretary of State. If you go to Washington today, it used to be called the Pan-American Union, what we know as the Organization of American States. That was Blaine's idea more than 100 years ago in an attempt to forge closer relations between the United States and Latin America. Clay had the same idea in the 1830s as John Quincy Adams, Secretary of State. So each of them had a visionary quality along with the practical politics. Blaine, as I said, became a lawyer like Clay in Kentucky, and then his career took an interesting twist. He was offered the editorship of a small to middling sized newspaper in Maine. Now remember, at this point, people bought newspapers not for their objectivity, but for their partisan ferocity. You know, again, you identified yourself by the church you went to, the party you voted for, and the newspaper you read. And so the editor was, on the face of it, part of the political process. So it was a very small step for Blaine to leave the printing press and become a member of Congress. And again, very quickly established himself as a star. He was Speaker for 6 years, went on to the Senate, and three times, 1876, 1880, and 1884, went into the convention leading. And twice was defeated by dark horses, Rutherford Hayes in 1876, and James Garfield, both Ohioans, both successful, both untainted by railroad ties, railroad corruption. But I'll tell you, if you think today's politics can be nasty, everyone knows in 1884, finally, Blaine wins the nomination. And his opponent is the governor of New York, Grover Cleveland. And halfway through the campaign, a story surfaces that Cleveland fathered a child out of wedlock. And Cleveland, you know, more or less acknowledges, frankly, he didn't know, but it is, he doesn't deny it. Within days, a Democratic paper is printing a story about Blaine having a son born 3 months after his wedding. Blaine explained, no, it was, in fact, there had been a secret wedding a year earlier in Kentucky. But I'll tell you how nasty it got. The boy died when he was a few months old. They went to his gravestone and chipped off his birth date. That's pretty, you know, that's pretty mean. I mean, I'm not sure I've seen anything in the current campaign yet. It's still early that compares with that. But that gives you a sense of the tenor of American democracy in the years after the Civil War. Blaine was also, within the Republican Party, a polarizing figure. You had two camps. There were the half-breeds. They were moderate reformers. Blaine was their leader. And then you had the stalwarts. They were the old guard. They were the machine, with Ulysses Grant as their star. And they hated each other much more than they hated the Democrats. And each of these conventions that I mentioned, you saw this play itself out. The ultimate moment, Garfield wins. He makes Blaine his Secretary of State. Blaine accompanies Garfield to the Washington Railroad Station on July 2nd, 1881. And unknown to them, they walked into the train station. Behind them is this frustrated office seeker named Charles Gitto, who shoots the president. Blaine looks up, and to his horror, he recognizes Gitto, who has been harassing him, trying to get a federal job. In fact, that he got in a couple times to see the president before instructions were given, don't let that man anywhere near the president again. What does Gitto say? He says, having shot the president on the scene, he declares, I am a stalwart and Arthur is president. Which, of course, immediately makes it, it was as if Lee Harvey Oswald had walked out of the Texas School Book Depository building and said, I'm a communist, and now Lyndon Johnson is president. It might have inspired Roger Stone to write his book even sooner, and others alleging LBJ's complicity in the crime. But in any event, I mean, politics was literally life and death. So now you begin to understand why people were so emotionally invested and how someone like Blaine, who to modernize may seem unexceptionable, was anything but. He would serve again as Secretary of State under Benjamin Harrison. And Harrison, who was not a particularly popular president, was nominated anyway for a second term. By that time, believe it or not, Blaine was too old. His ambition was finally running down, and his health was as well. So died at the age of 63. Burned out. Ambition will do that when it's as intense as Blaine's.
You mentioned several minutes ago, you mentioned Blaine, and you talked about him being, quote, the magnetic man.
Yeah.
Where did that come from?
It was, again, the newspapers were wonderful in the 19th century. They were always labeling people, usually scurrilously, you know, but sometimes brilliantly. The magnetic man was something that was coined by a newspaper. Clay was Harry of the West, except to the Democrats, for whom he was Judas of the West. But again, newspapers existed in large part to glorify or excoriate.
Okay. How would you describe his contributions to history?
Well, more significant than you might think. He, as I say, he was a first-rate Secretary of State. Unfortunately, he was not in any of his other jobs long enough. You know, he was Speaker for 6 years, which seems like, you know, but, and he was only in the Senate for one term. In a curious sort of way that can't be proved today, he demonstrated the power of charisma, of personal charisma, to overcome political deficiencies or ideological shortcomings. Also, he's the patron saint of unlucky candidates. The classic example is the 1884 campaign. This is one of the closest races. People forget, the years after the Civil War, people assume Republican domination. In fact, there were a series of very close presidential elections. In 1880, Garfield won nationwide by 9,000 votes. Now, even in a much smaller electorate, that was the closest race in history. And 1884 was going to be equally close. Here's something that everyone who's ever run for any office, particularly for the presidency, and particularly at the breakneck pace that we demand of modern candidates, can appreciate. And that is the consequence of exhaustion. What happens when you're physically exhausted? Well, at the last weekend before the 1884 election, it was a Thursday, and everyone realized the election was going to come down in New York. And whoever carried New York would almost certainly have the majority in the Electoral College. And so Blaine came to New York City. And he was met by what he later referred to as the Presbyterian horse's ass, a minister of that faith, who in his welcoming remarks took it upon himself to congratulate all of those present, and indeed everyone who supported the Republican candidate for president, because they were not the party of what he called rum, Romanism, and rebellion. Now, there's a certain amount of poetic justice here. You heard the phrase, waving the bloody shirt. I mean, for 20 or 30 or 40 years, you know, the Democrats ran against Herbert Hoover for 50 years. They may still be, for all I know. But the Republicans in the 19th century had their equivalent. They waved the bloody shirt. They kept reminding everyone that the Democrats were the party of rebellion. And unfortunately, however, when you were trying to carry Irish Catholic New York, and it was absolutely teetering on the edge, you did not want the opposition press to be able, in the next day's front page headline, to run this accurate, if jaundiced, statement to which you were too exhausted to even pick up and respond to. Had I'm convinced Blaine was shrewd enough, quick enough, smart enough, that he would have, if he'd really been listening, instead of sort of half-heartedly thinking, you know, what am I going to say, he would have diffused the effect. Instead, he let it go unanswered. And so the next day, hundreds of thousands of Irish Catholic New Yorkers woke to read this assessment, which, as far as they knew, reflected the views of the Republican candidate. Romanism, i.e. Catholicism, and rebellion. Blaine lost New York State by 1,149 votes, and out of more than a million. And with it went the presidency. And it illustrates one thing that's timeless about this business, and that is just you can spend all the money in the world, you can have all the experts in the world, you can have the greatest strategy, you can be eloquent, you can have all of these things going for you, but you cannot control the element of chance. And in the end, something as foolish as a Presbyterian horse's ass will cost you your life's ambition.
Okay. Our third subject today is William Jennings Bryan. Talk a little bit about his life and how he came to be called the Great Commoner.
Imagine a 36-year-old congressman, two-term congressman from Nebraska, defeated candidate for the Senate on the basis of one speech to his convention. Now, it's true, Barack Obama, on the basis of one speech in 2004, catapulted himself to national prominence and credibility as a would-be candidate in 2008. But think how exceptional that was. So you have some idea. I mean, Bryan was, at the same time, Bryan was the product of forces that had been gathering here in Kansas more than anywhere else. There was something called the People's Party, the Populist Party. Farmers, the inimitable Mary Ellen Weiss, 37-year-old mother of four, who is still remembered for telling the farmers to raise less corn and more hell, delivered 190 speeches of her own one election year on behalf of the Farmers Alliance, which was a political party in all but name. Remember, this was the era of the Grange. The Grange, which in its original form was not essentially a social organization or even a conventional advocacy organization, but it was overtly political. Farmers felt that they were getting the short end of the stick economically. Specifically, a lot of the unrest that bubbled up from agricultural America had to do with the currency. Now, I don't know about you, I long ago sort of tuned out to the more abstruse, you know, arguments about paper versus silver. I mean, there are people who understand that, and that's good, that's impressive. But life is too short to have to listen to them. Explain why. But basically, another way of putting it is inflation and deflation, something that we're all experiencing now. Farmers wanted to inflate the currency for obvious reasons. They were in debt, usually to Eastern banks. So it's no secret that, one, they wanted to inflate the currency, which meant coining silver instead of gold. Two, they didn't think much of Eastern banks, which meant Wall Street and the trusts, the monopolies that were taking shape at this point in American history. The quote is too good to ruin it. This is Mary Leese speaking. "Wall Street owns the country," she declared in 1890. "It is no longer a government of the people, by the people, and for the people, but a government of Wall Street, by Wall Street, and for Wall Street. The great common people of this country are slaves, and monopoly is the master. The West and South are bound and prostrate before the manufacturing East. Money rules." Well, 125 years later, there are probably a number of people who could quote Mary Leese. The East, you have to do a mental somersault. Politically, it's the opposite of today. The industrial East was the Republican heartland. Why? Because Republicans believed in tariffs, protectionism, high wages for industrial workers, job security that they thought, because industries were protected, workers felt protected. Remember, this is before the era of unions. By the contrast, the South and West were heavily Democratic because they were disproportionately rural, farmers, miners, other folks who looked upon what they thought was a raw deal. Why should they suffer economically? The price of wheat in 1870 was $1.07 a bushel. By 1896, the year Bryan ran for president the first time, it was 65 cents. Corn, cotton, same thing. Westerners, Southerners, and above all, farmers, looked at these trends and had no difficulty at all identifying the villains. The villains were Easterners, Wall Street, the high tariff people who wanted special favors for their segments of the economy, for their region, if you will, and let the devil take the hindmost. In 1896, the Democratic Party split in two. The only comparison would be in 1968. If you think about what Vietnam did to the Democratic Party, where Lyndon Johnson couldn't attend his own party's convention. Well, in 1896, Grover Cleveland couldn't attend if it had been the custom. He was rejected by his own party because he was a conservative Democrat, which meant he believed in the gold standard. Good is gold, which made him a friend of the Eastern bankers. There was a rebellion, a rump, grassroots rebellion at the convention. In those days, conventions still mattered. Conventions still nominated candidates rather than simply ratify what's already taken place. And what did they do? I mean, this unheard of. They rejected the President of the United States in favor of this 36-year-old former congressman from Nebraska who was a great orator and who, of course, gave one of the great speeches of American political history known as the Cross of Gold speech, which you can hear tinny recordings of if you go online. And he literally swept all before him. And then he did something that no one had ever done before. Bryan he's maddening in some ways because he is this incredibly modern figure. He's the first candidate to go out and take the stump. He gives over 500 speeches before Election Day. Now, to give you an idea of how energized people were in the 1890s, more people turned out in person to see and hear Bryan and McKinley, who basically stayed on his front porch in Canton, Ohio, and the railroads brought the people to him. 750,000 of them. But more people turned out to see and hear Bryan and McKinley in 1896 than 100 years later turned out to see or hear Bill Clinton, Bob Dole, and Ross Perot, which gives you some sense of how much politics mattered to people. This was a pre-television, pre-radio, pre-internet. It was the subject of barbershop conversation. It was the surest way to start an argument. You know, McKinley versus Bryan, the Eastern financial interests versus the, you know, long-suffering farmer. It was a form of class warfare. And Bryan took his case to the people in a way that no one had ever done before, and then foreshadowed modern campaigning. The Republican campaign is also the forerunner. I mean, if you read Karl Rove's book, or if you haven't, what the Republicans did with Mark Hanna, an industrialist from Ohio, as the godfather, was basically to hit up industrial America, hit up the richest 1%, and they raised $4 million, which was about eight times what Bryan and the Democrats had to spend. And they spent it on buttons and pamphlets and bumper stickers, and they mass marketed McKinley in a way that was utterly new. So 1896 is a real turning point. If for no other reason, Bryan deserves. But Bryan, he lost. It was a decisive victory, not an overwhelming victory. But then 4 years later, having fought this epic battle about something, that's the thing to keep in mind. 1896 was about ideas and about differing visions of what this republic was going to be. 4 years later was a second campaign about ideas. And the issue this time was not monetary, it was the American Republic itself. Remember, we'd fought the War of 1898, Spanish-American War, and American politics was split right down the middle as to what were we to do with the spoils of this war. In particular, should we annex the Philippines? Or should we, as we were doing with Cuba, give the Philippines their independence? And you stop and think, that's the first time Americans debate their place in the world. For 100 years, beginning with George Washington, the idea had been that the United States was an asylum for the oppressed of the world. It was a place that people would come to. It was not a place that would attempt to impose its values or its system of government, for whatever reason, on other parts of the globe. That changed. And McKinley, and of course Theodore Roosevelt, his candidate for vice president, was even more hawkish, if you want to use that term, more expansionist. But Bryan put together a coalition that you would recognize today. It was intellectuals, academics. Mark Twain joined the Anti-Imperialist League. Andrew Carnegie, the richest man in the world. You could draw, again, a direct line from that strain of liberalism, if you want to call it that, to the modern Democratic Party, certainly to George McGovern and others who, to some degree, well, Wilson was on both sides. But the notion that the United States had a higher, both sides agreed on one thing. Both sides agreed the United States had a moral calling. The expansionists believed that we had a moral obligation to lead the world in the direction of popular government democracy. And the anti-imperialists believe we had a moral obligation to remain true to our original Jeffersonian notion, to lead by example rather than military force. And Brian is leading the charge. He loses again. And then 8 years later, he runs a third time against William Howard Taft. And this time he's running against the trusts. But, you know, he can't out-Teddy when that issue is concerned. So then it's all downhill. Unfortunately, some people don't know when to quit. And Brian was certainly one of those. He became Secretary of State under Woodrow Wilson, is generally regarded as one of the worst Secretaries of State. He worried a lot, for example, about serving alcohol at diplomatic events. So he limited his offerings to grape juice, and a term was coined, grape juice diplomacy, which didn't work very well. When the Lusitania was sunk, and Wilson wrote a stiff note of protest, and most people, led by T.R., criticized Wilson for not going further, Brian quit in protest because he'd written a stiff note of anger to the German government. Brian said he was a pacifist. You probably don't want pacifists as Secretary of State. It's probably not an ideal job. And then, of course, finally, in his later years, Brian was in great demand as a speaker all his life. He was the number one attraction on the Chautauqua circuit, $500 a speech plus expenses. And then, of course, in his later years, became famous or infamous for his involvement with the Scopes monkey trial in Tennessee in 1924. Where he did battle with Clarence Darrow over the issue of whether the state could prohibit a school teacher from, in his classroom, teaching evolution as a theory. And there was, radio was brand new medium, and there was a live, just as the way that we all obsessed over the O.J. trial, Americans tuned in every day for their helping of the Scopes monkey trial on this new instrument of radio. So Brian, unfortunately, was introduced to a whole new generation as a bit of a buffoon.
How should, what should he be remembered for from a political perspective?
It's such a mixed bag. He should be remembered as the great commoner, as a man who genuinely, at a time when our politics were in danger of being subverted by money, he called our attention to the dangers and to an alternative vision of what our politics could be. He should be remembered as a man of principle who genuinely believed. He had no campaign consultants, no pollsters telling him that coining silver or opposing the annexation of the Philippines would be popular. He did it because he believed it. He rallied a very substantial, honorable part of the public to his side. And even later, it's easy to laugh at his days as a diplomat, but they were marked by honest conviction. And he took that with him to the grave. When he died 5 days after the Scopes monkey trial verdict. Appropriately, he went to church that morning, came back, ate too much, and had a heart attack. And that was sort of what his life had devolved into. He'd also become, actually, one of the first celebrity politicians. remember his advent on the national stage coincided with the press, the tabloid press, pictures in newspapers, and then radio. So he was a more vivid, and particularly in this part of the country. You know, Kansas voted for the Populist Party in 1892, and Kansas voted for William Jennings Bryan twice, which might surprise folks in Topeka today, but if you wait around long enough, things change. That's the ultimate lesson of history.
What are the things we should remember about these three individuals that apply to what's going on in the world today in our politics?
Well, I think the easiest way to answer that is to reiterate, even in times when questions were being raised about the probity of some of their actions, I think they were all honorable men who genuinely wanted the best they could produce for their country, and who went distinction and intellectual substance to our politics at a time when it was as easy to be cynical about politics and where we were going as it is right now. I mean, the fact is there are a lot of people who are appalled at, and I'm not talking about individual candidates or platforms. I mean, I think it's part of a broader culture that is clearly coarsened and to an alarming degree dumbed down. These people took politics seriously. They took governing seriously, and they knew the difference between the two. One of the legitimate complaints that I think can be made about both parties today is they don't realize that when January 20th comes around, things are supposed to be different. I mean, that's the beginning of something. There's a reason we call it Inauguration Day. Instead, egged on by the industry of political agitation, we have the permanent campaign. And the irony is that these three men, who were permanently ambitious, nevertheless were each in his own way enough of a statesman to distinguish when partisan politics was adjourned and popular government and hopefully some degree of national consensus took its place.
You've been listening to presidential historian Richard Norton Smith giving the first in the 2016 presidential lecture series at the University of Kansas Dole Institute of Politics. The series will continue with two more presidential lectures next month, the last of which will cover Kansas's own also-ran, Senator Bob Dole. This event was moderated on January 31st, 2016 by Bill Lacey, director of the Dole Institute. Audio was provided by Lawrence Bush. I'm Kay McIntyre. KPR Presents is a production of Kansas Public Radio at the University of Kansas.